You're listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. The Trust works with schools, colleges, and communities across the United Kingdom to educate about the Holocaust and its contemporary relevance. To learn more about our programs for teachers and students, visit us online at het.org.uk. From the Holocaust Educational Trust, I'm Alex Maws, and this is a special Remembering Belsen podcast. Remembering Belsen is a continuation of our 70 Voices project, which commemorates 70 years since the liberation of Bergen-Belsen by British armed forces. To explore all of the content from 70 Voices and Remembering Belsen that we've posted between January and April 2015, visit 70voices.org.uk or download the app available for most smartphones and tablets. I was delighted to be joined for this podcast by Professor Tony Kushner of the University of Southampton, who is widely regarded as the leading academic authority on Britain's relationship with the Holocaust. The liberation of Bergen-Belsen is often seen as a heroic moment, but much of our content in Remembering Belsen has shown that both survivors and British troops had ambiguous reactions to the liberation. So I began by asking Professor Kushner why this was the case.
For the survivors, I think we like to see them as this is the end, that they've gone through hell and then they're liberated. And for them, it's much more complicated. For some of them, they are too physically weak, too mentally scarred to fully appreciate it. And also, it's not all over. The numbers dying in the weeks, the days and weeks following is still horrific. So on one level, just the physical recovery takes some time for the survivors, but also mentally. There is a form of it being all over, but it's also a moment where they're starting for the first time to reflect on what they have gone through and what they have lost. For the liberators, this is something that they have no preparation for. And the shock, particularly for those troops and others who are going in the very first days, it's something that they cannot comprehend, and for the rest of their lives, this is something that is beyond, even for them, comprehension, something that scars them. It's something, I think, that hasn't been recognized sufficiently of how traumatic it was for the liberators, for the medical teams, for the chaplains, for all of those different groups of people. This was something that lived with them day and night for the rest of their lives.
It's generally agreed that the liberation of Belsen had an immense impact in shaping British awareness and understanding of the Holocaust. And yet, we've seen earlier on our 70 Voices commemorative platform that the British government and to some extent the public were aware of the mass murder of Europe's Jews as early as 1942. So why then did Belsen have such a greater impact than the earlier reports had had?
It's part of a process, and perhaps a process that is still ongoing, but there are detailed reports from at least the summer of 1942 onwards, and particularly for that period from, say, July 1942 to early 1943, intense reporting, intense campaigning in Britain. So on one level, you could say, well, what's new? But what you have with the liberation of the Western camps, especially Belsen in the British case, is the visual imagery, which is scarring. And perhaps that then connects with the earlier reports, whereas those reports came and went. For some activists, it confirmed what they knew, the scale of it, of the catastrophe as early as 1942. But for the general public, there wasn't anything beyond those reports which weren't sustained for the rest of, say, 43 and 44. So there's a big gap. And what you have is the whole horror exposed in 1945 and the ending of doubt that before this was something happening a long way away, and now this was imagery that could not be doubted. Even the radio broadcast of Richard Dimbleby shocked people. People remember where they were when they heard that broadcast. Dimbleby's genius in being able to communicate by words alone, the scale, the horror of what he had seen. So there is something very important about liberation of Buchenwald, Dachau, but particularly for the British, Belsen. And it goes alongside newsreels, the radio broadcasts, the newspaper reports, the exhibitions, a whole intense month, if you like, of descriptions and visual imagery. It doesn't necessarily mean that we understand what we would now call the Holocaust, but there's an understanding of the horror of what had happened, the scale of destruction.
And following on from that, you have written extensively about Holocaust memory in Britain, and you've often pointed out that the centrality of Belsen in Britain's understanding of the Holocaust has given rise to some widespread misunderstandings about the history of the Holocaust. Can you explain a little bit more about some of these misunderstandings?
What I think we get with the liberation of Belsen is an assumption, understandably, very understandably, of that this is the worst of Nazi atrocities, that this is beyond description. The metaphor that's often used is of Dante's Inferno, of something unimaginable hell. And so it's not surprising that that is regarded as the height of Nazi atrocities. And that leads to a sort of shortcutting of what had happened, that Belsen is a peculiar camp, it has a peculiar history. And what it reflects is in some ways the end of the Holocaust, of the death marches and so on. So it is intimately connected to the Eastern camps, the camps of destruction, particularly Auschwitz, but it is a camp with its own history, and that is not really understood. And there are various aspects that aren't properly understood at that time, including the Jewishness of the victims, but also that this is a camp that did not have gas chambers, and so that there is slowly an awareness of some of the mechanisms of the destruction process, particularly of the gassing of Jews. And it's therefore assumption that you put those two things together, that if Belsen was horrible, Belsen was a sign of Nazi atrocities against its victims, and that the gas chamber is the ultimate symbol of Nazi destruction, then there must have been gas chambers at Belsen. And you can see that even if it's at a sort of crude level of Sex Pistols in the 1970s, their song Belsen Was a Gas, however offensive, A, reflects that Belsen has a resonance in culture, if abused in their way, but also that false assumption. They're trying to be deeply offensive, but their history isn't very good.
You touched on something a moment ago that also Professor David Cesarani touched on in our previous episode of the podcast, about the Jewishness and the extent to which the Jewishness of the victims and the survivors of Belsen was recognized. Professor Cesarani talked about the ways in which they weren't sort of separated out from even from possibly Nazi perpetrators who were in Belsen. Was this an intentional thing, or is this actually just sort of a source of misunderstanding on the part of the British?
I think it's a mixture of both, that there is an intentionality. That on one level you could say, well, if you've got a mound of dead bodies, of rotting bodies, these are hard to recognize as human beings, let alone as Jews, gypsies, or whoever. But on another level, there is definitely an attempt to downplay the Jewishness. We see it most blatantly now, because it's only now really been put together properly, of Sidney Bernstein's film of the liberation, where the Jewishness is downplayed. But also in dope sheets for newsreels, where the Jewishness is deliberately crossed out, that there will be indications of how the people are to be described, and they will be described as Jews by the cameramen and others, and that will be crossed out. On another very blatant level, and often adding to the confusion, Richard Dimbleby carried out two broadcasts for the BBC, and sometimes the one that wasn't broadcast is used to illustrate it now, and the one that wasn't broadcast does refer to Jews. The one that doesn't is the one that was used by the BBC, and it's, you know, again, an indication of how we need to be very careful with using historical evidence, of not using the wrong broadcast, because they're similar but not the same. And it's not also a qualification, and it's not total. If you have papers like the Manchester Guardian, News Chronicle, which have been deeply sympathetic to the Jewish cause throughout the Nazi era, they do refer to the Jewishness. And it isn't, as we see with Dimbleby, a matter of ignorance. You can understand that someone wouldn't understand who these people are. But Dimbleby was talking to the people. He knew about that they'd come from Auschwitz, many of them. He was aware, but that is taken out. And it's not done in a crude, horrible way, but it's an attempt to universalize experience. So this is not, at this time, about creating sympathy for the victims. It's about labeling the enemy as barbaric, as other. And at this stage, it's not the Nazis, it's the Germans who are seen as responsible. And so that's what it's all about. And anything that might confuse that picture with victims who are seen as not 100% unproblematic, i.e. Jews, that is downplayed. And it's partly about, this is against liberal principles, but it's also about Palestine in the background, in the British case.
Our listeners to this podcast who've also been following along on the Remembering Belsen and 70 Voices app will remember reading this week also about how Britain dealt with some of the perpetrators with the Belsen trial in the autumn of 1945. Was this typical of Britain's approach to perpetrators of the Holocaust?
I think in many ways it was. You can read the trial documents and see that there is a picture. There are Jews who are called as witnesses. There is reference to the Eastern camps, which there has to be because of some of the perpetrators coming from Auschwitz and many of the victims coming from Auschwitz. But the tendency to downplay victim witness and to choose non-Jewish, if possible, English-speaking victims, this is part of that universalizing tendency. And the confusion of East and Western camps is sort of typical of that genuine confusion at that moment. And I think that is understandable, you know, grasping the whole complexity of the final solution instantly is asking a lot of contemporaries. One last point is the very crude defense of some of the people being prosecuted by British Army office. Obviously, he's there to do his job, but some of the comments about the victims being sort of the sweepings of the ghetto reflect one tendency, not a major tendency, but a tendency in British society, which I think has got a parallel today, that 95, 99% of the British population are horrified by what is going on in the Mediterranean of people, hundreds, thousands of people losing their lives in desperation. But there are still one or two idiots who are referring to these people in derogatory, racist manner.
I suspect that many people would say that the Holocaust today has come to occupy a more central place in Britain's collective memory than it did in the earlier post-war years. Why do you think that that might be?
I think there are various factors. That it's not that it wasn't there after the war, but it was a different shape. It was within a construct, I would argue, of Nazi atrocities. This is about atrocity stories, not disbelieved, but about horror, about the evils of Nazism. Today, it's a more nuanced picture. It includes the victims much, much more. It also includes the bystanders. And I think this was not inevitable that the Holocaust had become so huge in today's popular consciousness, because it's become, if you like, the morality story of today. And one reason for that is it is in the past, that yes, we have the last lingering trials of the perpetrators, but for the most part, it is in the past. And there has been recognition of guilt, at least by the major perpetrator nation, if not by some of the other collaborator nations, or if you take the example of Austria, fully coming to terms of the past. Nevertheless, there is a sort of set pattern now. It's not as live as other contemporary issues. But it also has this neat pattern of the perpetrators who are evil, the victims who are innocent and pure, and the bystanders who are a very mixed set of people. So the possibility of empathy, certainly with the victims, possibly with the bystanders. I think we have problems still in any way identifying with the perpetrators, which on one level is reassuring. None of us want to be seen as that. But nevertheless, you know, ultimately there are still perpetrators around us. in everyday life, and we still have that dissonance there. But it, so it has, you know, there are other horrible human stories from recent times which have not reached that level. And yes, the Holocaust has its intensity, its immensity, but it wasn't inevitable in 1945 that it would become the moral story of the, say, the late 20th and 21st centuries.
And I think so much of what you're describing about the way that the Holocaust is remembered in our contemporary world is often a case of the complexities of the Holocaust being sort of glossed over. And it, so much of what we've talked about today has highlighted that Britain's relationship with the Holocaust was and remains much more complex than the sort of heroic narratives which were often presented with. So why is it important that we preserve and acknowledge this complexity?
I think it's because it is so central to the way we think about morality today that we don't see it in clear-cut terms. Yes, when we're dealing with the perpetrators, you know, this is not, you know, some relativism where we excuse what they did. We need to contextualize. Eichmann, for example, you know, was an ordinary person, an extraordinary bureaucrat, an extraordinary figure, and an anti-Semite, in spite of his denials of that. But he's not someone that is a, you know, sort of carpet-biting lunatic. He's a rational, intelligent man. But more generally, I think the nuances, particularly in terms of relevance to the British case, is of that of dealing with victims and dealing with their complexity, not expecting them to be saints. I've spoken to many survivors who are, you know, amused and slightly disturbed by the way they're treated. And just to give you a silly example, Trudy Levy, who sadly passed away, a survivor, she came to speak to Southampton. And when she was driven from the station to the university, students would drive like lunatics because they were just so in awe of her presence. And they thought, you know, she's been through all of this and I'm going to kill her on the road. And they would compensate and drive. You know, they couldn't, you know, she's just an ordinary person who has a rich life, had a rich life beyond that of being a Holocaust survivor. But, you know, to treat victims as human beings with all the complexities and that, you know, being persecuted does not necessarily make you a better person. But even bigger, I think, is, you know, being the bystander nation, and that, you know, Britain's role is not as liberator and as rescuer alone. There are other sides to it. Yes, Britain had many aspects of its refugee policy which are surprising. Say from the 1920s, it's surprising how many people actually got into Britain in the 1930s compared to those in the 1920s, when the refugee crisis was far bigger, far, far bigger than the 1930s. So we need to recognize that there were exceptions made, loopholes created, blind eyes turned to how people were getting into the country. I think one of the most striking of these is through domestic service, not the most happy route to get in as a refugee, but one which 20,000 women did, with the full knowledge of the government bodies that they weren't going to stay in that profession very long, much to the annoyance of all other aspects of society. But so this was, you know, yes, it wasn't the nicest route, the easiest way to recover your sense of normality, but it was a way of getting to safety. But it was, you know, so there's restriction and there's openness. Even within the kinder transport, which is becoming the celebrated moment, a mixture of motives of those that brought the children in, sometimes economic exploitation, sometimes worse, alongside the love and care that was given to them. And the whole scheme itself, you know, why the children, not the adults. So there's all of those ambiguities. This is, you know, I think we need to get beyond the accusatory and beyond the celebratory, which, it, you know, I think is to do full justice to Britain, that it was a policy that was a set of policies and responses that was ambivalent, and that there are aspects which I think we can see as remarkably positive, considering the context, and others where we think, well, they could have done more and it wouldn't have harmed anyone. So that, I think, is the nature of being a bystander and trying to move beyond the ambiguities to a less compromised position.
Professor Tony Kushner, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. This series is just one of the ways in which the Trust promotes greater awareness about the Holocaust and and ensures that it has a permanent place in Britain's collective memory. If you'd like to make a financial contribution in support of this work, or to learn more about our programs, visit us online at het.org.uk.